content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with a couple of short things from AARP, the magazine, an exclusive book excerpt. This is Treasures from the Dylan Vault. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, there's a museum dedicated to the life and works of Bob Dylan. A new book, Bob Dylan, Mixing Up the Medicine, takes you inside and shares rare and never-before-seen photos and artifacts from the collection, glimpses into his seven-decade and counting career. Here are just a few of the book's many private images and descriptions. So let's start in the beginning, 1957. And so we show him as a young man with a bunch of his friends. Bobby Zimmerman, with guitar, grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota, and spent four summers at a camp in Wisconsin. Fellow camper Louis Kemp, who later produced one of the singer's tours, said he saw Dylan's first public performance at the camp when he played Hank Ballard's Annie Had a Baby with Larry Keegan, who's also in this picture. And then, 64 to 2003, Brothers in Song. Johnny Cash reached out to Dylan to express his admiration. The feeling was mutual, and the two became close. And this picture shows the two of them together in London in 1966. And one's at the piano, and the other one is sitting there with a very thoughtful look on his face. A few years before Cash's death in 2003, Dylan performed Cash's Train of Love at a tribute concert. Said Dylan, in introducing the tune, "I used to sing this song before I ever wrote a song." And there's a photo here of a note from Johnny Cash, April 8th, 1999. "Hi, Bob. It was 1955, and I was in the dressing room at Louisiana Hayride with Sam Phillips, Elvis, and Luther. Sam asked me if I had written anything new. I sang the first two verses of Train of Love. He said, 'Finish it, and let's record it.' Memories. You brought them all back. Nice memories. Thank you, Bob, for doing my song. You looked great and sounded great. And thank you for the kind words. With much love and respect, your friend, Johnny Cash." Now we have inspiration from a fellow poet, 1975. Poet Allen Ginsberg rekindled Dylan's love of beat poetry and prose. On tour together in 1975, they communed at novelist Jack Kerouac's grave. Early, Ginsberg had recorded an album setting William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience to music. He wrote to Dylan about the effort in 1969. Now, the handwriting's a little hard, but I'll give it a try. "Enclosed a pamphlet with reading and memorable, whatever, you or one's first, Rustin, by Prima. I'm almost finished with recording the 20 or more melodies and Blake's songs of something and experience that have been working on for a full year. I couldn't deal with the business, even in time, and so finished the production myself and learned studio manners and means as I went along." And I'm not going to finish it because it is very difficult to read, but it's signed with, as ever, faithfully in poetry, Jack. No, excuse me. Well, we'll just say faithfully. So let's move on to 1987. With friends caught in a rare smiling pose, Dylan sat happily with Beatle George Harrison at a Los Angeles concert featuring poet and singer John Trudell. and slide guitarist Jesse Ed Davis. The concert turned into a jam session with Dylan, Harris, and their pal John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival, each taking the stage to play full sets. Then Blood on a Track, 1993, the singer, revered blues artist of the past. In the 1990s, Dylan covered Blood in My Eyes, a 1932 record by Mississippi Sheiks, and shot a video for it in London. Dave Stewart of the duo Eurythmics directed in black and white. Then Portrait of the Artist, 1999, Dylan, who was shown here at age 58, has sat for countless photo sessions, including this one at the defunct and now demolished Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, where Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1968. And this picture shows him in a big old soft armchair with a newspaper in front of him. Seen from the never-ending tour, 1988 to question mark, Dylan has been on the road consistently for decades. This 2001 card game among bandmates, David Kemper, Tony Garnier, Dylan, Larry Campbell, and Charlie Sexton, took place on his bus tour in Telluride, Colorado. I see that I could stop touring at any time, but then I don't feel like it right now, Dylan once said. I've got no retirement plans, and this picture shows all of them in a card game, and they look quite comfortable. Now, also from the magazine, we're going to look at another section of This is 70. This one is entitled The Season of Farewells. When saying goodbye becomes all too familiar. Not too many people attended the funeral of my coworker, Margaret, but I did see my pal Dennis Gallagher there. Dennis and I had a pleasant time exchanging nostalgic stories about our late friend. A few weeks later, I went to the funeral of a colleague on a charity board, and once again, I ran into Dennis Gallagher. Maybe 2 weeks after that, another funeral. Dennis was at that one, too. As we were shaking hands, I made a poor joke. "Dennis," I said with a chuckle, "we can't keep meeting this way." His reply was immediate and accurate. "Oh, we're going to keep meeting this way," he insisted. "At our age, the funerals of our friends are becoming a regular part of life." How right he was. Like other 70-somethings, I've found that the funerals of friends, classmates, and professional acquaintances have become standard calendar items. And to my surprise, I find that I enjoy them. Most of the friends being buried had long, fruitful lives, so these occasions are not particularly gloomy. And often in the quiet church or synagogue, I find myself conversing in my mind with friends and relatives who have passed. My mom and dad, my sister, Dee Dee, my wife, Peggy, even my Navy commanding officer, a guy who had a big influence on my life. In some cases, these ceremonies involve nothing more than the standard funeral liturgy. But the better ones offer a look back at a life. Sometimes there are slideshows to remind us of what the deceased achieved in a lifetime. The best life story I've heard came at the funeral of my friend Bob Cicada. In 1942, when Bob was a high school junior, the Cicada family was taken away from their California farm and locked up in an internment camp because Bob's parents were immigrants from Japan. Bob, American-born and bred, he had never even been to Japan, was furious at this treatment. To get out, he finagled a job as a farmhand in Brighton, Colorado. The farmer assigned Bob to work 40 acres along the South Platte River. By the time of his death, 80 years later, Bob had 4,000 acres along that river, and Cicada Farms was one of the biggest growers of sweet corn, cabbage, and onions in the Rocky Mountain West. As we left the church in Brighton, after Bob's funeral, his grandchildren handed out packets of corn seeds. Occasions like that made me think about my own funeral, which is probably not so far in the future. I guess my family could show clips from my PBS documentaries. except they might bore people to death. Many of my books were total flops in the marketplace, and I have boxes of unsold copies in the basement. Should my kids give them away at my funeral? Some of the funerals I've attended lately have included a military color guard with a uniformed bugler playing taps. As a former Navy person, I want that. The Department of Veterans Affairs tells me I can make the arrangements at va.gov/burials-memorials. Since I'm no longer attending many balls or banquets, funerals have become an element of my social life. When a friend or colleague dies, the memorial ceremony is a chance to mingle with people I don't see often anymore. In fact, one major social occasion, not long ago, was the funeral of none other than my pal, Dennis Gallagher, who died at age 82. Dennis had been a popular local politician. He had served as a state legislator and Denver's city auditor. His funeral drew hundreds of people, including present and former mayors and governors. As I walked down the church aisle to take communion, I put my hand on his coffin and bade him farewell. "Yeah, Dennis, you were right," I whispered. "We're going to keep meeting this way." T.R. Reed, 79, is the author of 10 books in English and 3 in Japanese. After a long career with the Washington Post, he has become known for his essays on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Now, a couple of short little tidbits of wisdom. In their own words, Diane von Furstenberg, 76. "I would change the word aging and say living. Instead of saying, how old are you, people should say, how long have you lived? And automatically, it changes everything." Put your brain in neutral. Memory slipping? Use these simple hacks. You've got things to do, people to see, bills to pay. It's a lot to juggle, and your memory may not be what it used to be. These tips can lighten the burden on your brain. Designate a go basket. Set a spot for the items you need when you leave the house. Keys, wallet, work ID, sunglasses. Get in the habit of dropping your essentials in a basket or bowl placed there when you arrive home every day. Solve the password problem. A password manager stores all your passwords in a highly secure online vault that's accessible via one master password. Don't like that approach? Then write your passwords down on a sheet of paper and place it in a book you'll remember on a nearby shelf. Standardize your grocery list. With a printed list of your go-to items, you'll save yourself a return trip to the store. Keep it on the fridge or the counter and check off items as you run out. Pay bills on time. You can set up auto-pay to take check writing off your to-do list, or set up an electronic calendar reminder on your smartphone ahead of the date. Now, last time we started an article, Henry Winkler's 6 Lessons of Reinvention, and we just did the introduction, so now let's go on to lesson number 1. Take the good with the bad. Winkler grew up a child of German-Jewish immigrants in 1950s-era New York City. As a boy, he struggled with an undiagnosed case of dyslexia, the neurobiological learning disability characterized by difficulties decoding written language. "I was so verbal, yet I couldn't do anything in school. It drove my parents crazy. They embraced the conclusions of my teachers, which was, you're not living up to your potential, which eventually became, you are lazy and stupid." Winkler limped through high school and an undergraduate degree in theater at Emerson College. In 1973, after graduate work at the Yale School of Drama and a short run in New York theater, he moved to Los Angeles. Just weeks after arriving, he landed the initially small part of author Fonzie, on the new sitcom Happy Days. Over the show's 11 seasons, he became an international superstar. "We have to talk about Happy Days," I tell him, almost apologetically. "It's okay," Winkler says quietly. He knows how much he owes the show. Fonzie had only 6 lines of dialogue in the pilot. Still, he immediately delighted audiences. The writers quickly shifted the emphasis of the show, giving Winkler more and more screen time, until Fonzie eventually became a focus. His explosive popularity never waned. By way of example, Winkler describes his first date with his future wife, Stacy Weitzman, in 1976. After 3 seasons as Fonzie, Stacy wasn't familiar with his character or the show. She wanted to go to the movies, he said, and I told her that might be difficult. She wanted to know why. I said, I don't know how to describe it to you. When we got to the theater, I told her we should sit in the back. She didn't understand, so we sat in the middle of the theater, and the entire theater came over and said hello. And Stacy said, oh. Throughout the run of Happy Days, Fonzie was promoted and merchandised mercilessly, enough so that it would be easy to write him off now as a lunchbox caricature. The show eventually ended, though it was 7 years after Fonzie literally jumped a shark while water skiing. The source of the catchphrase that describes the point where TV shows and other stuff pass their moment of cultural relevance. Winkler remains proud and protective of the legacy of Arthur Fonzarelli. Still, there was a cost to having played the popular television icon. I never resented the Fonz. He put a roof over my head, said Winkler. But after Happy Days, I struggled with being locked out of opportunity. And let's look at what exactly is dyslexia. The struggle, the humiliation, the frustration is like living with a 3,000-pound weight on your shoulders, is how Henry Winkler describes his lifelong battle with dyslexia. He's hardly alone. Up to 1 in 5 Americans have this learning disability, among them California Governor Gavin Newsom, Nobel Prize-winning biologist Carol Greider, and actor Whoopi Goldberg. Dyslexia is caused by biological differences in the brain that make it difficult to map speech sounds to letters or sequences of letters, so it's hard to recognize written words. In the 1950s, dyslexia was not widely recognized as a condition, and many people with it grew up being labeled either stupid, unmotivated, or oppositional, explains Rebecca Resnick, a psychologist in Bethesda, Maryland. Older adults may still carry that shame. Actors, of course, have to read. Winkler says he has developed a process, a negotiation, for dealing with a script, which gives him a way to absorb the words and sentences on his own terms. I put it down and walk around and look at it. You negotiate it. You think. You figure out exactly how to do it. Dyslexia runs in families. If one parent has it, there's a 40 to 60% chance a child will be born with it too. If you suspect you may have undiagnosed dyslexia, a specialist can test you and set up a treatment plan if it's needed. Find a specialist in your area through the International Dyslexia Association's provider directory at dyslexia.org. That's dyslexiaida.org. New technologies can also help. Audiobooks are easy to get, and many publications offer audio versions as well. Pen-size reading devices can scan text and read it aloud. In addition, text-to-speak software lets you convert a digital service's text so that it's read aloud. Now let's look at lesson number 2. Learn to do whatever you set your sights on. In the years that followed, Winkler could not get cast in movies. So strong was the association with Fonzie. He refers to it as a kind of personal walk in the desert. I knew it was necessary to figure out something else because I was completely stymied, he says. I couldn't just sit there. I had a family, and I am a doer. Winkler went to work. In 1984, his lawyer said he would start up a production company for him. I told him, I'm an actor. I can't do that other thing. Winkler recalls, but it turns out you can even learn what you can't do. Then you get good at it. So Winkler produced, and he excelled at it. In 1985, he won a daytime Emmy for a children's after-school special. His company put together MacGyver, the popular and weirdly inventive show about a secret agent, which Winkler executive produced for 7 years. During that time, Winkler also directed two films with big stars, Memories of Me with Billy Crystal and Cop and a Half with Burt Reynolds. But acting roles, his first love, had dried up. So we'll go on with the rest of the lessons next time. Now, let's look at a few places to vacation in the wintertime. Big sun and small crowds. At these off-the-beaten-path winter vacation destinations, you'll find unique experiences while avoiding packed beaches and overpriced hotels. We'll start with water, water everywhere, Jupiter, Florida. Average high temperatures, upper 60s and 70s in January and February, 70s in March. Don't let the lavish mansions of surrounding golf courses fool you. Jupiter, some 90 miles north of bustling Miami, is a laid-back beach town. Until I-95 bisected Jupiter in the 1980s, it was a quaint little coastal seaside town with a freshwater river that was filled with freshwater animals, like alligators and otters, says Rich Clegg, 66, a Jupiter resident since 1979. Now it's a lot more accessible, but still has a small-town feel. Sitting at the confluence of the intercoastal waterway, the Atlantic Ocean, and the Loccahatchee River, Jupiter begs to be explored by boat or paddleboard. Talk about serene. One seven-mile stretch of the river is off-limits to motorized crafts. You're almost entirely in the shade of the Grand Cypress canopy, Clegg said. It feels prehistoric. But we all know that the beach is one of Florida's main draws. Jupiter has nearly 3.5 miles of beaches, some ADA accessible and others dog-friendly. At every high tide, aquamarine water floods into the Jupiter Inlet and is simply rapturous, said Clegg. While there, check out the 108-foot-tall Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse. Hardy travelers can climb to the top, but you don't have to go all the way up to appreciate the views. When you need to dry out, catch a spring training game starting in February 2024 at the Roger Dean Chevrolet Stadium, where the St. Louis Cardinals and the Miami Marlins play. Don't miss. Learn about sea turtles and participate in their recovery at the nearby Loggerhead Marine Life Center in Juneau Beach. It includes an outdoor hospital, several aquariums, and a beach from which healthy turtles return to the ocean. Now let's look at a small town that's big on art, Ocean Springs, Mississippi. Average high temperature, 50s and 60s in January and February, 60s in March. The Secret Coast. Even locals call it that. Mississippi's Gulf Coast is a 62-mile stretch of scenic shoreline that includes 29 miles of white sand beaches, and Ocean Springs serve as a great home base, especially if you like art. The late famed painter Walter Inglis Anderson, a preeminent 20th century Southern artist, lived in Ocean Springs. See his work at the Walter Anderson Museum of Art. Walter's brother, Peter, was a renowned potter, and the annual Peter Anderson Arts and Craft Festival is a major Gulf Coast event, says Anthony DeFata, director of education at the museum. We're like Mayberry with culture, he says. When you're ready to enjoy the outdoors, take an 11-mile ferry trip to Ship Island in the Gulf of Mexico. Offering only day-use facilities, restrooms, showers, a pavilion, and a concession stand, and no overnight resort hotels. Ship Island feels secluded with pristine waters. Ocean Springs, by contrast, is more built up with restaurants, boutiques, and brick enclosures on the beach for bonfires. Mature oak and magnolia trees line the sidewalks of this charming town. Don't miss the legendary Ruskin oak. Measures more than 28 feet in diameter and sits in a suburban lawn. To see this sprawling tree is to experience the lush landscape of the South. Now from AARP The Bulletin, let's take a quick look at a face of a caregiver. These people are working to improve caregiving and have been caregivers themselves. Senator Tom Tillis, 63, Republican from North Carolina. Tillis is the top Republican on the Senate and Finance Subcommittee on Social Security, Pensions, and Family Policy. He was a caregiver for his grandmother, who developed Alzheimer's in the mid-1990s. My grandmother lived independently in a sort of family setting. Her daughters lived on either side of her. She started having the classic problems. She wrecked her car coming out of the driveway. So they had to limit what she could do. I got involved explaining to my mom and aunts that she really needed full-time care. There was a really nice facility 7 miles from where she lived. We got her over there. It demonstrated to me that there are limits to what a loved one can do to provide care without dramatically changing their lives. Then we have Senator Maggie Hassan, 65, a Democrat from New Hampshire. She is an original co-sponsor of the Better Care, Better Jobs bill that would enhance funding for home and community-based care. She's a caregiver for her son, Ben, 35, who has cerebral palsy and lives with her and her husband, Tom. We have a team who has helped us, but we have more often than not been the night shift for caregiving. And if a nurse calls in sick or a respite worker can't come, Tom or I or our daughter are going to the people who take care of Ben in the daytime. It does make you realize how tenuous the situation can be. It's one of the things that's really helped me focus on policy that would stabilize the system. There is growing recognition that this is not just good for people and respects people's independence, but it is essential as we work to stabilize our healthcare system and grow our economy. Well, folks, I see that we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.